This podcast contains adult language and subject matter.
Getting it in front, a backhand in front, Hasek with a miraculous save on Quats. Do you believe? Oh, brother, we are not worthy.
Dominik Hasek is on two shortlists. Greatest goalie of all time, and most unusual goalie of all time. His 16-year NHL career, split between stops in Chicago, Buffalo, Detroit, and Ottawa, was incredible. It was a cocktail of confounding moments on and off the ice. He was a character between the pipes, inside the dressing room, and away from the rink. He won two Stanley Cups and picked up a boatload of individual awards, including 6 Vezina trophies in an 8-season span. He was the Dominator. I'm John Mattis, and this is When Goalies Were Weird, a narrative podcast from The Score. Each episode tells the story of one unforgettable 1990s era goalie. In the 90s, there was no more fascinating position in all of professional sports than the hockey goalie. These goalies were just plain weird. They played weird, with weird hybrid styles and funky mechanics. They looked weird and acted weird, with weird helmets, superstitions, and bad tempers. The position was undergoing a revolution in style and substance, as the butterfly goalie replaced the stand-up, while advancements in equipment technology helped usher in a modernized, more athletic playing style. The old guard's quirks and the new guard's innovations melded together to produce an era of pure chaos in the blue paint. It was the most bewildering amalgamation of players hockey has ever produced, and one fans will never forget. There are a couple of widely held interpretations of Dominik Hasek, his playing style, and his illustrious career. Both are true, though one is more accurate than the other. The first is that Hasek was an acrobatic, flexible, spastic force of nature who thrived off being unpredictable. His style was unorthodox and, at times, theatrical. The second is that, yes, he was all of those things, but also a man in complete control. Below that layer of unpredictability was a structurally sound, rhythmic goalie. His secret to success was an innate ability to outthink the opposition. Take it from somebody who would know, longtime NHL goalie coach Jim Corsi.
His game was, as many think of it, as unorthodox, but I saw him day in and day out do the very same thing on a whole bunch of different players, but in similar situations. So what seemed like the highlight of the night, oh, look what he did here, was actually something thought through. And that is stopping the puck and using athleticism, reactive skills, and blocking skills. I often say it in this simple fashion. He thought like a player, but played like a goalie. So his ability to anticipate the game and get himself in the way was quite remarkable.
Corsi started working with Hasek in 1998-99, the final season of a ludicrous mid-career run in which Hasek racked up 2 Hart, 2 Pearson, and 5 Vezina trophies in 6 years. If Hasek normally saw the game unfold in slow motion, it was in super slow-mo then. Corsi recalls being stunned at Hasek's ability to decode the game in real time, especially during a debriefing that year following a game against the Montreal Canadiens. Hasek had been haunted by a power play goal scored off a bang-bang play at the Sabres net. Not only did Hasek know a player was laying in wait for a cross-grease one-timer, but he'd already thought ahead to what the outcomes could be based on the player's stick-handedness.
So what happened? Like, how did you see that play? Did you know that the guy was there? Oh, yeah, I knew. But I thought he was right-handed. There's a high, low, cross crease. Like, 3 different things are happening and a one-timer from the side of the net. And he's going, I thought he was right-handed. Like, I'm concerned. I'm saying, did you see the guy there? He says, oh, yeah. I didn't pick up that he was right-handed. And I walked away and I go, what the heck was that?
A decade into his retirement from pro hockey, Hasek is a singular figure in the sport's history. He was both super advanced on the mental side and supremely athletic. This made his exploits perplexing to the untrained eye. If you showed a non-hockey fan a miraculous save from the Hasek archives, they'd probably scoff and say, ah, he got lucky. It would be a reasonable reaction too, considering he undoubtedly did get lucky. Yet, the sheer volume of highlight reel saves over his career suggests luck was responsible for only a tiny fraction of Hasek's success. He didn't fluke into ranking first in career save percentage, seventh in goals against average, and tied for sixth in shutouts. Hasek was brilliant, fearless, strange. But the improv? Yeah, that was minimal. His old boss, Sabres general manager Jerry Meehan, certainly didn't mind the antics.
I just thought it was entertaining. I just thought he was, you know, different. He found a way to stop the puck. I mean, if you asked him why he did it, he'd probably say, well, that's the way I figured I could stop it. If there's a puck going to the top corner of the net and he's otherwise occupied with his gloves, so he sticks his head up and stops it with his face mask. I just think it was his natural, innovative, creative self in the net that made him unique and made him effective. Watching the games and the outcomes, as long as he stopped them, was fine with me.
Hasek was the first NHL goalie to consistently freeze the puck with his blocker hand. On his knees and seemingly out of position, he would often drop his stick for greater mobility and then launch himself, blocker first, at the loose puck. It became a signature. Other times, he would release his stick before stretching out for a few adult-sized snow angels. Or he would turn it into a baseball bat and whack pucks out of the zone. Then there was the patented Hasek roll, where he would fall onto his side to block the entire lower half of the net, goading the attacker to travel across his body for a small opening before spinning around to cut off that opening with a double pad stack. He even deployed the heel of his skate for a so-called scorpion kick save on a few desperate occasions. Hasek seemed to never give up until the goal horn sounded, and nobody can forget the extreme measures Hasek took to challenge players skating in on a breakaway. Like a soccer goalkeeper chasing a lonely ball, he'd fly way out of his crease, sometimes earning a penalty for sending his opponent head over heels.
Here's a breakaway, look out. Hasek coming out! Oh! Gavrik! Whoa! Right over top of Dom!
Is
he going to get a tripping penalty? What's he going to get? But Dominic Hasek came out.
What?
And he's going to get a trip. He can't believe it.
Former Sabres defenseman Randy Moeller shares a quintessential Hasek sequence.
I think we're playing the Devils. I can't remember. 2-on-1, and I got the guys on the side. You know, I'm trying to stay in between them and that and just wait so it's just to take away the pass. And all of a sudden, the pass come over, and I look over my shoulder, and Dominic has dove right out, knocked the puck out of danger, hit their player, ended up half, three-quarters of the way to the blue line, And then gets up and loses his stick and scrambling around and skating backwards back over towards his crease and that. I mean, this was a game by game thing with him.
It sounds absurd now, but the Hasek critics were out in full force early in his NHL career. Some wondered if Hasek's circus act would eventually get on teammates' nerves. Others argued his style was unsustainable and reckless, given how frequently his limbs flailed. According to the man himself, none of this early career analysis entered Hasek's orbit because the native of Czechoslovakia hadn't yet mastered the local language.
I think my best advantage was that I didn't understand English. So there were some complaints in the papers, there were some complaints about my style, but I didn't understand what they say. You know, I found out maybe a year or two years later what the coaches said and what was written in the papers about me. And it was one of the reasons I never really changed my style. I stick with what worked for me.
Michael Pekka, one of Hasek's good friends back in the 90s and an ex-Sabres captain, said teammates never tired of or got used to Hasek's exploits in the crease. The variation in his save-making created the same suspense for them that it did for outsiders. The end result, mind you, did plenty for Pekka and the Sabres. Hasek was the club's lone superstar, and having a quote-unquote one-goal goalie allowed everybody else to puff their chests out. It gave them that extra boost of swagger. Before Corsi joined the Sabres, there was Mitch Korn, another legend in the goalie coach community. Korn and Hasek clicked, and like Corsi, Korn came to understand that order and patience gave all of Hasek's fantastic weirdness an opportunity to flourish.
I often say that playing goal is like a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. And it takes you a long time to ensure that you have all 1,000 pieces. Some guys don't have all 1,000. And it takes a real long time to get all 1,000 pieces actually put together because there's some that are outliers. They don't fit, whatever it is. Dom is one guy that I could tell you had 1,010 pieces. He had extra pieces. His big job, our big job, was to put them together, make the pieces fit. once the pieces fit, he is arguably one of the top goalies ever to have played the game and certainly deserves the Hall of Fame nod that he received.
Here's Hasek kicking it into the corner right on the Bure stick. Bure drops it off to Lume again. Lume, ready to go, Chris. Oh! Hasek just robbed Bure. Bure throws his arms up. He cannot believe it. Dominic Hasek robbed him blind.
It's hard to comprehend what exactly attracts someone to want to play goal in hockey. Think about it. The objective of the position is to do whatever's possible to stop a vulcanized rubber disc from crossing a painted red line. In the NHL, pucks zip towards the goalie at up to 100 miles per hour, and the player firing the puck is motivated by one thing: scoring. He couldn't care less if the goalie gets hurt along the way. Really, the position is one ongoing occupational hazard, which is why practices have always been a safe place. It's where keeping goalies in good condition is a priority. Now, I'm here to tell you Dominic Hasek never cared for this line of thinking. I should clarify. It's not as if he wanted to get hurt in practice, obviously. He simply had no fear of getting hurt.
He had such a calm demeanor. I can remember him in practice telling the players to shoot high, shoot high. You know, shoot high, shoulders, shoulders. You know, where every other goal in, you know, I played with Eddie Belfour and Patrick Roy, you shoot high on them and then come after you in the corner. Like all other goalies, they hated it. But, you know, Dominic, he was... That didn't bother him. He wanted to get better at the shots up there.
That was Cam Russell, the former NHL defenseman. Hasek and Russell were teammates within the Blackhawks organization. Both new to the NHL system, they split time between the big club and the Indianapolis Ice of the old IHL. Most scenes from that period are foggy 30 years later, Russell says. But since deliberately shooting a puck at your own goalie's head is considered a cardinal sin in hockey circles, he's never forgotten those workouts. In fact, Russell told me he has yet to encounter another goalie who's asked his teammates to shoot high. And Russell's been a player, coach, or manager at the junior or pro level basically nonstop for the past 40 years. He's seen everything. Still, this wasn't some one-off experiment for Hasek. This was who he was. Fire away, Hasek told his teammates in Chicago, and Buffalo, and Detroit, and Ottawa, and then Detroit again when he came out of retirement at the age of 41. Hasek uses a skiing analogy to explain the bizarre habit. To be successful on the slopes, you must adopt a fearless mindset. Fear produces bad results.
So fear of the puck was number one. Number two was I just want to try to make with the head because sometimes it needs to happen. You know, sometimes you use the head to stop the puck. It was many times during the season you do it. And number three, just... I don't know, just to have fun with my teammates and make them to be pissed, you know, like I'm not afraid of them when they're shooting at me on the top of the head. So a little bit of everything.
Teammates were understandably confused, but it was just another of Hasek's many eccentricities. We already knew he was crazy, is how former Sabre Jason Daw put it. Here's another example. To feel completely finished for the day, Hasek needed to stop a certain number of shots in a row to end each practice. He was that obsessive. Dave Hannon played with Hasek in Buffalo for four seasons. He remembers it like this.
He would like have a number that he would want to stop in a row, whether it was 5, 10, 15. I didn't do it all the time, but I figured if I can go down on him all the time, it could help me, my skill set, to what's the release of my shot, how fast am I doing it, where do I usually beat him. If he stopped like 13 or 14 and you scored him on that 15th, he'd start again and do it again. You'd have to stay out there with him. And of course, you know, we're teammates and we're all trying to make sure we're helping each other. He was that kind of competitive guy that he wouldn't leave the ice until he had finished and he had in his mind that, okay, I stopped 10 in a row, 10 breakaways in a row. I'm happy now.
Hasek's backups, on the other hand, had a less glamorous point of view, says goalie turned broadcaster Martin Biron.
Try having to be on the ice during practice with the greatest goaltender to ever play. And the players on the ice are basically saying, everybody, if you want to build your confidence, go to Marty's side. The rest of you guys go the other way and shoot on Dom. Like that's how like it was portrayed in practice because he wouldn't let you score. He definitely would not let you score. So if you're a goal scorer and you haven't scored in four, five, six games, you're not going against Dominic Hasek in practice because your confidence will be shot by the end of the day.
Korn, the goalie coach, noted Hasek had an unbelievable learning curve too. He would be taught something during practice and then executing it in the next day's game. This attention to detail extended to his equipment choices. Remember that iconic yet ugly player's helmet and cage combo Hasek wore throughout his career? It was not a fashion statement. No, it stuck around for practical reasons. The modernized one-piece goalie mask was simply too bulky for Hasek's liking. His 80s look allowed for better peripheral vision because it fits snug to his face. Hasek would tinker with his goalie stick, shaving down the paddle so he could grip it like a trigger. He also would build up the tape on only one side of his stick's knob, so when the stick ended up on the ice, it would lie completely flat and act as a last line of defense. Former Sabres backup Steve Shields compared Hasek to golfer Bryson DeChambeau, who has gained a reputation on the PGA Tour for modifying his clubs. Here is Shields on another equipment alteration unique to Hasek.
Well, when I got to Buffalo, I noticed that Dom had the inside of his knees built up a little bit so that when he did drive down, his knees had these landing pads. And so he had his pads built. He was the first guy that I saw that if you look at the outside of his pads, they were one height and the inside was lower. So when he rolled them, they would go together perfectly.
This restless part of Hasek's personality didn't fade away as he aged. One anecdote from his first season in Detroit suggests his fiery side actually intensified over time. Hasek had been acquired from Buffalo in the 2001 offseason to put the Red Wings, a team filled with future Hall of Famers, over the hump. Wednesday, December 5th was circled on the calendar as Hasek's first true test with the powerhouse Colorado Avalanche in town. It turned out to be an ugly night. The Avs won 4-1. Hasek allowed 4 goals on 18 shots. The next morning, Wings GM Ken Holland pulled into a spot in the Joe Louis Arena parking lot for practice and noticed Hasek's car. Holland always arrived before the players, so he asked the trainer what the deal was. The trainer took him to the team's stick room, where 6'2" Hasek was curled up on a couch, sleeping with a blanket. Holland couldn't believe his eyes. Hasek, his $8 million goalie, was punishing himself for not playing up to his own standards during a regular season game. Teammate Kirk Maltby said he wouldn't put his worst enemy in this particular stick room. It was filthy and buried deep in the bowels of the crusty 20-year-old rink.
At the very back, where you can't go any further, there was a door with a little room, maybe not even 10 by 10. And that's where we would always cut our sticks. And there was a little, not a full-out couch, like a sofa. And there might have been a chair back there, if I remember, and an old tube TV up in the corner. And you wouldn't spend much time back there other than cutting your sticks and stuff. And guys would cut their sticks, sand their sticks, torch their sticks, whatever they had to do. And so it was just, it didn't get a lot of attention on the cleaning side of it from anybody. It wasn't a room you went back there to kind of sprawl out, turn the TV on, watch TV and go to bed and sleep the night, because I mean, I never saw one, but it wouldn't surprise me even if there was maybe the odd rat droppings back there.
Hasek confirmed the story, though he couldn't recall precisely why he was so upset. It was probably the sting of getting embarrassed by rival Patrick Waugh and the Avalanche.
I think after the game, I fell down and so I lay down on the couch and then I said, fuck, I don't even want to go home. So I called my wife and said, I'm staying home. I don't remember exactly what happened, but I'm sure it had to be after losing game. And I don't think I ever done it before or after.
Mario's going to have to give him a little different look. Here's Lemieux again. He got around Chelios. Knocked down though. Beat it ahead of Stevens in a great play. Around Hasek, and Hasek challenges him to come out and knock it away. Dominic Hasek, another big goaltending effort.
Picture this. There's a tree, there's a trash can, there's a goalie, and there's a shooter. This no-frills setup was Hasek's introduction to the concept of goaltending as a youngster growing up in Pardubice, Czechoslovakia. Born in 1965, he first hit the ice in a pair of goalie pads in the early 70s.
The hockey was number one sport and in the city, and I like to be the goalie. I never thought about being the goal scorer or something else. Even when I was younger, I always made the net on the ice or on the grass. And I asked my father or grandfather to shoot a ball or the tennis ball at me or the puck on the ice. So I was born to be the goalie.
One of Hasek's lifelong friends is Frank Musil, the ex-NHLer turned longtime amateur scout. When they grew close in grade 3, two things started to really stand out to Musil. Number one, Hasek's skinniness, even for a prepubescent boy. And number two, Hasek's natural athletic abilities.
Probably, one of the best I've seen. I mean, he sensed the game, whether he played soccer or basketball, he was at the right place at the right time. In tennis, his position was good. And he was never the strongest, the fastest, but just, you know, his sense and intuition and anticipation was unbelievable.
On the ice, Hasek was carving out a niche as one of the best young goalies in his hometown. He was a dependable netminder who had essentially taught himself how to play the position. But he also had this adventurous streak that would drive coaches nuts.
He would be getting bored when he didn't have enough shots, so he would wander outside of the crease, which, you know, in those days were taboos, and coaches would be yelling at him. But he attempted to play the pucks and get out of his crease and make those little passes and then struggle to get back. But somehow he would recover and make those saves. You know, we would all be shaking hands on the bench or on the ice, but you knew when you made a mistake, there was a very good chance that he would cover your butt.
Around this time, young Hasek also gained a reputation for being late and forgetful. Musil remembers his friend would come up with these creative excuses for his tardiness, but the act got old in a hurry. Coaches and players on Pardubice's top youth hockey team resigned themselves to the fact that Hasek was that late guy you can find on any team. And then, on one road trip, Hasek didn't realize he had forgotten his equipment until the team bus was rolling into the arena parking lot in Kladno, a city 100 miles west of Pardubice. Frank? I think I forgot my pads, Hasek told his seatmate. Musil shook his head as a coach, who was seated within earshot, laid into Hasek.
But what happened, they borrowed the pads from, I think it was a junior team there from Kladno. I can't remember if we won 1-0 or 2-1. He was the best player, you know, in the game. And it just, I think more adversity just, you know, drove him to be that much better. Right? It was just, that's so dumb. Yeah.
The pair's friendship hit a rough patch when Musil defected to the United States in 1986. Czechoslovakia was a member of the Soviet Union, and leaving a country under communist rule was a dangerous, life-altering maneuver. Hasek didn't want to risk never again seeing his family and friends, so somewhat begrudgingly, he stayed put. On the ice, he had become a juggernaut in the Czech League. After making his pro debut at 16, Hasek collected 5 Goalie of the Year honors and 3 MVP trophies in the 1980s. His club team won 2 championships, and he appeared in more than 100 international games. In 1990, with the Iron Curtain lifted, Hasek finally left for North America. His stock had risen significantly in the years since the Blackhawks selected him 199th overall and 17th among goalies in the 1983 NHL draft. Yet, he wasn't walking into an ideal situation. Eddie Belfour, Chicago starter, was himself a star in the making. Hasek played just 25 regular season games for the Blackhawks over 2 years. He debated going back to Europe during his sophomore season, calling up Hawks GM and coach Mike Keenan at one point to voice his frustration about the goaltending logjam. On August 7th, 1992, Keenan traded Hasek to the Sabres in exchange for backup goalie Stefan Beauregard and future considerations, which proved to be a 4th-round pick used to select power forward Eric Dauze. The 1993 NHL expansion draft was 10 months away, and Chicago could protect only one goalie. A trade, Keenan told me, was the lesser of two evils. Here's then Sabres GM Jerry Meehan on the perspective from the other side of the table.
We started the discussion kind of on a casual way, and I knew that they were committed to Eddie Belfour as their number one goalie, and there they were sitting on an asset that they were using infrequently. And yet his numbers when he played were better than just about anybody's in the league. So that struck me as, well, you know, something's going on there because here's a guy who has great numbers, but he's not getting in the net. It just occurred to me that Chicago had to make a decision that their loyalty was to Eddie, and it was well-deserved. So like any, you know, good organization, they probably said, well, you know, there's a guy that we're not using to his full potential. What can we get for him? And it went from there.
Hasek's first year in Western New York was turbulent. He won only 3 of his first 13 games and was later sidelined by a stomach injury. It was easy to lose faith in Hasek, thanks to his lack of NHL experience and weird playing style. In February 1993, the Sabres acquired Grant Fuhr from the Toronto Maple Leafs. Hasek was placed on waivers around this time. And, according to Keenan, the Hawks filed a claim in an effort to reel him back to Chicago. Keenan told me the league denied it, because not enough time had passed since the Sabres-Hawks trade had gone through. Anyway, Hasek remained a Sabre and continued to hit it off with Korn. For the first time in his career, junior or pro, Hasek had a goalie coach focusing on him and his game every single day. The best part was that Korn promised he wouldn't force any drastic changes upon Hasek. Instead, he wanted to refine his unorthodox style. Korn believed Hasek was the Sabres goalie of the future. So shortly before protected lists for the NHL's expansion draft were due to the league, he wrote a letter to his boss.
I actually begged Jerry Meehan to protect Hasek and expose Fuhrer. The knees, the shoulders were starting to go. I put it in a memo, and I can still remember my statement. My statement was, Hasek can play. You just have to have a strong stomach to watch him.
Meehan didn't listen. He protected Fuhrer, exposing Hasek. However, neither the Florida Panthers nor the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim took the bait. The Panthers didn't pick a Sabre, while the Ducks selected Bill Holder and Bob Corkum. And the rest is history. Hasek broke out the next season, posting a .930 save percentage. He took home the Vezina Trophy at the year-end awards show and finished second in Hart Trophy voting. Korn was right. This guy could play.
And a chance now for Getzlaf, moving in. Oh, what a save, Hasek!
The Dominator. Hasek has one of those impeccable nicknames, right up there with the great one for Wayne Gretzky, the Rocket for Maurice Richard, and Mr. Hockey for Gordie Howe. What's been lost in time is that it took a few tries before the hockey world landed on the Dominator. Keenan called him Dr. Dom for a bit in Chicago. Broadcasters loved labeling him Gumby. And, briefly in the early 90s, he was known as the Count. Yes, the Count. Like Count Dracula. Korn has the backstory.
We're going on a road trip, and we're getting on the plane, and he had an overcoat. He did not put his arms through the overcoat. He buttoned the very top, and back in medieval times, it looked like a cape. And one of the guys nicknamed him the Count. Back then, if you look at the old movies, right, there was a Count. He did not like that. And it hung around until he got good. And when he got good, it disappeared in a hurry. Replaced by the Dominator.
That anecdote describes Hasek to a T. In hockey's monolithic culture, he was a pretty weird dude, somebody who didn't fit neatly into one box. Unprompted, multiple teammates used different bird to describe Hasek's personality, with one hinting there are Hasekisms not appropriate for public consumption. That's not to say Hasek wasn't well-liked or well-respected. He was a good teammate, a leader by example, and let's face it, his talent alone granted him instant credibility. What made him stand out, though, was this interesting combination of high intelligence and aloofness. There was a lot going on between the ears, says Pekka, the ex-captain.
You know, I think his brain operates at such a high speed. He just seems very intense all the time. So when he engages with you one-on-one or if it's in a crowd or whatever it is, it seems like he's talking fast and he seems almost spastic, like the mad scientist type thing, like his head shaking around, even though it's not, but it's like everything's going real fast. And I think it's just because his brain's working so fast, his mouth's trying to keep up and everything's trying to keep up with it.
It was common to find Hasek in his own world on the team plane. He would be buried in a book or engrossed in a game of electronic chess instead of playing cards with the group. Korn recalls Hasek would often beat the computer because, like in the crease, he always aimed to be a few steps ahead of the opponent. I can't help but think of that famous Zach Galifianakis gif cut from the casino scene in The Hangover. I'm sure you've seen it. The clip shows the eccentric actor sitting on a blackjack table, counting cards like a savant, as math formulas swirl around his head. By all accounts, that's Hasek. He was process-driven, detail-oriented, and ever-curious. When SportsCenter highlights were on in the Sabres' dressing room, for instance, Hasek didn't necessarily care about who won or lost on Monday Night Football. He was fascinated by the strategy and thought process behind the NFL quarterback's play calling. This fanatical mindset bled into his intermission routine, which included some fingernail maintenance.
He came in between periods, and it was like a shift worker on his break. I mean, Dom would come in, put his stuff down. He would pick up the clippers from his bag. He would just sit there, like, and his mind would just go to another place. You know, we really wouldn't talk about the game. He would just, you know, settle into this routine. And then with a minute to go, it'd be like, okay, let's go, guys. And then we'd go back out there. I think that's just what, for him, worked.
You just heard again from Steve Shields, Hasek's backup for three seasons in Buffalo. Shields watched Hasek constantly arrive at the rink just in time. While the rest of the team wrapped up a 30-minute warm-up before a 5 o'clock pregame meeting, there was Hasek waltzing in at 4:59. The lanky Czech would casually slip off his dress shoes, slink to the floor, and as the coach began talking, stretch it out with his suit and tie still on. This kind of behavior would be deemed super strange and perhaps a bit disrespectful if Hasek were not a superstar. He got the benefit of the doubt because of how good he was. That said, Hasek and his peculiar ways weren't safe from the typical ribbing that goes on within each team. Jason Woolley, the former NHL blue liner, shares a funny story.
I was the guy in Buffalo that I had a radio show. One of the sponsors of the show was Nextel. That was the deal guy. So I loved getting everybody those cell phones that were, you know, beep, like they're like walkie-talkies back in the day. So I got the whole team cell phones. So it'd be like 99. The problem was every time I get it on the damn plane, Dom would be yelling from the back, Hey Woos, what's my phone number? I'm like, shit, dude. Like, just write it down. Remember your own freaking numbers. I got you the phone for nothing to start with. You're not doing anything. You don't have to do any signings. You don't have to do anything. But that wasn't what he was all about. He's just goofy. And you know what, though? He was quirky. He was goofy. But at the same time, he fit right in.
In full equipment, Hasek projected a certain vibe. Steely, confident, hardworking, dominant. In plain clothes, he was goofy. He had a witty, dry sense of humor. And thanks to an unremarkable body type, he resembled an accountant, not an athlete. Hasek wore high-waisted jeans with a tucked-in golf shirt. His brown hair was frazzled. If a random person saw him shirtless at the beach and had to guess what he did for a living, professional athlete probably wouldn't make the top 100. He was more or less Kramer from Seinfeld. Yet, at the peak of his powers, Hasek was world-class and did require special treatment. Pekka recalls a classic moment at Toronto's Lester B. Pearson Airport that involved security guard Frank Henry and an aloof Hasek.
Dom just needed help getting from place to place every once in a while without getting mobbed. So he thought it was a good idea, instead of flying out of Buffalo, he'd fly to Toronto to go back home or go somewhere so he wouldn't be as bothered by crowds of people. Still, when he got to the airport in Toronto, people were still mobbing him. And, you know, Frank Henry tells a story, he's like, Dom asked me, he goes, we're up here. He goes, how do they even know it's me? He goes, well, it may start that your socks say Dominator on them. He may have had a Dominator shirt on too. So like, I don't think he looked at himself as like he was this superstar elite athlete. He just looked at himself as any regular guy, and how would anybody notice him or even know him as the Dominator sort of thing. So it was kind of funny to hear that story.
And the Oilers bring it back. Chetan. Across the line, drops it, in for Waite, going in on goal! Oh, what a save! Waite had Hasek beaten, and Hasek got the right hand out and made an outstanding save.
Dominic Hasek's resume is overwhelming. He owns multiple Stanley Cup rings from his tenure with the Red Wings, cashing in as the starter in 01-02 and the backup in 07-08. On the international stage, he willed the Czech Republic to an Olympic gold medal in 98 before adding a bronze in 06 as the number two guy. Hasek is also the only goalie in NHL history to win multiple Hart trophies and multiple Ted Lindsay awards, snapping up one of each in back-to-back seasons in the mid-90s. Only Jacques Plante, who played in the original six era, has more Vezinas than Hasek's six. Wayne Gretzky once told the New York Times that Hasek didn't have an identifiable weakness. There was no book on him, Gretzky explained, and the stats don't disagree. In a whopping seven seasons, Hasek scored a save percentage that was at least .20 higher than the league average goalie. For example, in 98-99, the NHL average was .908. Hasek posted a .937 in 64 games while backstopping an imperfect Sabre squad. What does Biron think about these unreal stats? In his mind, is Hasek the goalie goat?
It's hard to go and say Jacques Plante and Terry Sawchuk and Glenn Hall and Ken Dryden in the same conversation as Hasek and Roy and Brodeur and now Carey Price and whoever. But you have to kind of see in that era where you were amongst your peers. And I think Dom in the 90s and early 2000 was by far above and beyond the best goalie. Everybody would have put him number one every year as to what he did and how dominant he was. So I still think he's number one. I think he's the most dominant goalie that's ever played the game for his era, for his time.
The spotlight was kind to Hasek. He was beloved in Buffalo, Detroit, and Eastern Europe. He made tens of millions of dollars. He's a Hockey Hall of Fame inductee. But you can't talk about Hasek's impact and legacy without touching on the lowlights. Specifically, one infamous altercation with a member of the media. Hasek verbally and physically attacked Jim Kelly, the late Buffalo News reporter, during the 1997 playoffs. Kelly had written about how Hasek was crumbling under the pressure associated with carrying the Sabres year after year after year. Kelly believed that, by sitting out with a sprained right knee, Hasek was bailing on his team when it needed him the most. Rattled by Kelly's insinuations, Hasek berated the scribe a few days later, when they bumped into each other in a hallway. This is how Hasek remembers it all going down.
I grabbed him. I push him to the wall. My face was like, I don't know, 10 centimeters or 5 inches from each other. But I didn't do anything, like I didn't punch him at all or something like that. I just sort of grabbed him and pushed him and told him a few bad words. So like I said, it wasn't like he was hurt physically, no. You know what I mean? Just, I don't want to say that what I done was good, it was wrong, but there was no any punch or something like that. I just tried to tell him that fuck you or whatever and push him a little bit.
Teammate Jason Dahl witnessed Hasek blowing a gasket on Kelly and immediately jumped in to defuse the situation. Hasek, Dahl recalls, was so mad he was trembling. Hasek told me he immediately regretted the incident, labeling his actions stupid. The NHL handed Hasek a 3-game suspension and $10,000 fine. Hasek later apologized to Kelly in a meeting arranged by Sabres management, and the two shook hands. Keep in mind, Kelly had recently publicized plenty of dirt on Hasek, including that the goalie had trashed a dressing room and lost his cool in practice. While extreme, this wasn't some phase. Hasek was an emotional guy who, in Daw's words, would snap out of nowhere. According to Daw, during one road trip in the 96-97 season, Hasek freaked out after head coach Ted Nolan called an audible on the upcoming off day schedule.
So we're on the plane, we got our meals, we're eating, playing cards, we're having our chicken parm spaghetti, whatever. And Jim Pizzatelli, our trainer, Pizza, comes back and he tells us that Teddy called a practice for the next morning. And Dom literally snapped again, hits the card table, spaghetti parm goes flying all over the place and like lands on a brand new suit. But once again, there's his temper, right? Like he was completely snapped over just us possibly having a meeting or a practice the next morning to get things straightened around, you know, but that's dumb.
At the time, there was a power struggle between Nolan and GM John Muckler, and the tension had infiltrated the dressing room. On top of that drama, Hasek apparently wasn't pleased with the way Nolan addressed young Czech forward Michael Groshek. That's one of many theories out there anyway. Pekka had this to say when pressed about the genesis of the Hasek-Nolan feud.
I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard different theories where it was started more as a conflict between Ted Nolan and John Muckler, and Teddy was supported by LaFontaine and Muckler was supported by Dominic Hasek, and that started some of that. I really don't know. You know, even as captain, there's certain things that, you know, you want to make sure you know what's going on, and there's certain things that you feel are none of your business. I think it wasn't affecting our team and the play of our team. So I didn't feel that it was something I needed to get involved in at all. They had issues and they had to, you know, hopefully resolve them. And it was unfortunate that Teddy, you know, after winning the Jack Adams, no longer was coaching our hockey team.
Nolan was replaced by Lindy Ruff, who in his second season guided the club to the 1999 Stanley Cup final. Brett Hall and his iconic foot in the crease goal eliminated Buffalo in the third overtime of Game 6. That was the closest Hasek Sabres would come to a title. 2 years later, he requested a trade out of Buffalo and ended up in Detroit. Hasek became the final piece as the stacked Red Wings won the cup. The 37-year-old goalie was the third wing to hoist the trophy, right behind legendary coach Scotty Bowman and captain Steve Yzerman. "He's trying to out-bench press any goalie who's ever held it," the TV commentator laughed, as a joyful Hasek wheeled around the ice with the cup. From there, Hasek oscillated between retirements and comebacks.
And after 2002, after winning the cup, I said, it's enough. I won the cup, and all of a sudden I felt like I still want to play hockey. So I made some decisions because it was the way I was feeling. You know, I was feeling like I don't want to get ready for the next season. And if you don't feel emotionally like, okay, you really want to do it. You really want to be the best. You don't want to be the one who helps the team to win a game, you know. So I feel like it's why to do it. It's better don't do. I always felt like I still can do something for hockey. I can still do something for the team. And so I came back and I never regret it.
Hasek may have spent a late career season in Ottawa, but his true hockey homes were always Buffalo and Detroit. During his second cup year, he and Chris Osgood were a tandem through the regular season, but by the end of the playoffs, Osgood was the clear number one. It wasn't a surprising development. Hasek was 43 years old, ancient for a goalie. After raising the cup, it was time, once again, to let go and depart the NHL. Hasek went on to play one season each in the Czech Republic and Russia before retiring for good following the 2010-11 season. He's now a 56-year-old businessman who, just this fall, welcomed a third child into the world. A seasoned entrepreneur with political clout, Hasek has flirted with the idea of running for office in the Czech Republic sometime in the future. As for his past, Count Wing's teammate Kirk Maltby, among those who both marvel and raise an eyebrow at Dominik Hasek and his career all these years later.
What he did as a player was arguably maybe the best goalie to ever play the game. His style, completely unorthodox. It's not like, you know, you would have a goalie go to a Dominik Hasek school and learn all these techniques of the butterfly and pushing side to side. It's about dropping your stick and doing rolls and stuff like that. There's no, you know, it's just a crazy style, you know. And then just as a person, obviously extremely competitive, one of the most competitive people I've ever met. The mindset of a goalie, the cliche is, oh, he's definitely a goalie a little off. Well, Dom was a little different for sure, but not necessarily in a bad way, but he had the mindset to be a goaltender.
When Goalies Were Weird is a podcast by The Score. Nick Roy is the audio engineer. Nick Ferris is a reporter and researcher. Guy Spurrier is an editor and producer. And Rory Bars is an editor and the executive producer. Thank you for listening.